Welcome back. Another episode of Art and Dressing Times. It's my pleasure to have back on the show Dr. Alan Sobrowski. He is a writer, a consultant specializing in national and international security affairs. He's a Marine Corps veteran, a 1986 graduate of the U.S. Army War College. He's has held current adjunct professorships at Georgetown University and Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. He's published many books, among which are Alliances in Foreign Policy, The Recourse to War, and Appraisal of the Weinberger Doctrine and Prisoners of War, Nation States in the Modern Era. Dr. Sobrowski, how are you doing this morning?
Doing very well. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for coming back on the show. Today I want to discuss with you, what's been occurring, acutely since October 7th, but this is a long issue, of course, going way back several decades. The world is witnessing what appears to be Israel's ethnic cleansing operation in Gaza, and all the time getting the full support of the U.S. government and the entire West, which suggests, reveals the Jewish state's apparent control of U.S. foreign policy. And what I see appears to be the virtually entire political establishment has been implicated in Israel's war crimes. We see legislation that is obviously in accordance or being directed for Jewish interests. Just recently, a $95 billion foreign aid package was passed by the Congress, signed by the president. This is going to funnel $61 billion more to Ukraine to continue that depopulation operation. $26 billion to Israel so it can continue genociding Palestinians and other mischief, of course. There was also, I think it's within that bill, a law requiring the seizure of TikTok, supposedly because of Chinese, but really it's because TikTok is a platform which isn't really completely controlled by the ADL and other Jewish interests. There's a lot of criticism of Israel and Jews on TikTok, apparently. The Jewish histrionics since October 7th, calling it the worst day in history since most Jews killed since, guess what, the Holocaust, yeah. The clampdown on universities, the purging of university presidents at these Ivy League schools, Harvard and Penn State, for allowing protests to occur, protesting Israel, and legislation being passed, I think, in several supposedly anti-woke governors and conservative governors, like in Florida and South Dakota, are signing laws that are clearly contradictory or in violation of the U.S. Constitution, supposed anti-hate speech laws or anti-Semitism laws that are clearly directed at political speech. And I see this as sort of a Jewish apocalypse, sort of as a great revealing, as understood, I think, in the original Greek. Something is happening. So what do you make of it the past 6-7 months?
I think that what it shows on the first part is that they are so overt, they being Jews, are so overt in their manipulation of governments and their direction of government officials to enable legislation and restrict speech and protest that is unfavorable to Israel, that they are certain they have won, and they no longer even pretend to conceal it. ADL hasn't even pretended for at least 2 years. But now they're not even presuming that there should be a fig leaf of objectivity on the part of politicians. And I think they're right, by the way. What is really interesting about this and about the protests, let's do the campus protests first. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people who aren't directly under the thumb of ADL or AIPAC or the rest of it, somehow see this as a renaissance in which students have had scales taken from their eyes and are acting different than the woke agenda would presume. That's not true. This is the anti-Israel protest, and they're not pro-Palestine, they're anti-Israeli protests. And they are explicitly because for the first time in all of Israel's wars, where it has bombed the bloody hell out of Palestinian civilians and Palestinian cities, that they are seen on their cell phones, usually from Arab students who have friends in Gaza. They are actually seeing what is happening, independent of what the mainstream media is showing them on television. They can see it. They can see buildings being blasted. They can see piles of women and children blown to pieces. They can see old men sitting in the ruins of their homes. They can see it, and they don't like it. A lot of these protests are being led by Jewish students in their teens and 20s. And the ADL has noticed this and has talked about Greenblatt specifically, the president of ADL, has talked about the generational problem that ADL faces, that they have to look at this. Well, that's not true. On everything else, the campuses are hard left, are hard woke. So it's a one-trick pony, but it's one that is sufficiently unsettling to places like ADL that they are reacting to it. The broader political spectrum, what I have been personally distressed by is that there have been damn few political figures out there who even gave a hint of being relatively even-handed when it came to Israel, when it came to what was happening with American policy, even though they would never mention that most of the neocons are Jews, particularly in the Republican Party, that most of the neoliberals in the Democrat Party are Jews, that half of the Biden administration's key appointments are Jews, dual citizen Jews, as was Trump's, as was Obama's, as was Bush 1, as was Clinton. Bush, Daddy Bush and Reagan were probably the last one that had a non-Jewish majority in their cabinets, certainly in their key positions, but wasn't all of them. But when they're looking at them, those people, people like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in the Democrat side on the Senate, former Democrat Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem. I mean, these people have always been outliers. People like Ron DeSantis down in Florida, Greg Abbott in Texas, and Donald Trump have always been Israeli partisans, right? First, last, and always, no question at all. You know, Trump even did the same thing that Bill Clinton did. Daughter converted to Judaism, married a Jew. But these people in the last 6 months have been absolutely different than they had been before. Tulsi Gabbard stood up on October 7th, 8th, and said, I stand with Israel, we stand with Israel. So I guess she has political hopes for 2024 when the Republican convention meets. And she has stopped talking about regime change wars, even though the war drums for Iran are beating very hard. Kristi Noem was very much of an outlier. And somehow our friends at ADL, they must have something in their background, because I don't think either Tulsi or Kristi could be bribed. So they could be either blackmail or the political equivalent of the lead or silver offer that the Mexican and Colombian drug cartels give Mexican officials. You know, you can either take a bribe or you can be killed along with your family. Well, I don't think that ADL is quite on that line, but it can certainly ruin them politically. And it has done so in the past. It has ruined people in the past. Democrat senators like Adlai Stevenson III and congressmen, both Republican and Democrat. So they know it's not an idle threat, that enough money and resources can be marshaled to take them out of office. So they may be doing this grudgingly, but they can certainly be done. And Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has got to know that the Israelis were involved in the assassination of his father, and before that, his uncle, the president, has got to know that. And absolutely quiet and back, quiet in terms of criticizing Israel and supporting them, openly supporting them. And none of them will mention the Jewish factor explicitly. They will always talk around it. you know, neocons, regime change wars, foreign influence, but they never point directly at it, not even in the past. I saw and posted on BitChute under my name, Alan Ed Sabrowski, a very scatological video by a group of British women. You can still say British women, and not quite Islamic women yet, or African women, but they're getting there, which goes at different governments and things that governments are doing and rips them apart. And I'm not going to use the language on the air here since I don't know who is listening to it, but go to my channel on BitChute and look at it. It's the most recent one. They pointed out that there are three conflicting truths presented very scatologically, by the way. There are three conflicting truths. One is that even the partial Palestinian targeting of some Israeli citizens, civilians, not as many as were claimed, but some, is a violation of international law. And two, that the collective punishment by Israel of Palestinian civilians in Gaza is a violation of international law. And three, that both one and two are taking place in the context of an occupation, a Jewish occupation of Palestinian land, of Palestine, which is illegal and a violation of international law. And why we are F*CKED is because the mind, obviously, in governments, for whatever reason, cannot hold these three truths simultaneously. And that, I think, says a great deal about the influence that has been exerted on us. 50 years ago, 60 years ago, the networks were not all controlled. Hollywood was, right from the beginning, in fact. Mm-hmm. But not the networks. Not the networks. I mean, you had a real diversity of opinion on the networks early on. And it's so much so that there was a space set aside at some point in the show in which, I would say, David Huntley and Chet Brinkley or Eric Severide or Walter Cronkite would explicitly have a section that they would say a minute or two set aside for their opinion. And the word opinion would be slashed across the top of the screen. So you knew it. And you could tell the opinion from the facts that were presented beforehand. Those days are long gone, and they're not coming back.
Yeah, there's been a sort of a gradual quiet revolution that's occurred in the United States, and particularly at the West, but I guess you could, our focus is on the United States, since the 1960s, particularly after 1967, and the ending of the Vietnam War. You had sort of the ascendancy of Jewish power through the 70s into the 80s, and it sort of culminated. So with the Reagan administration, the neoconservatives, that then it was covered up with the Cold War and Afghanistan and the Soviets. And then the end of the Cold War, I think the cultural agenda started really picking up in the 90s and into the 2000s. Of course, you had 2001, the September 11th attacks, again with another incident which hasn't quietly been explained correctly to the American people, which also there's a lot of evidence for Israeli Jewish involvement in that. It certainly served their interests, because it started all these wars in the Middle East, in that area, that certainly fulfilled the Oran Inyan plan, which I think was written up in the early 80s, right? To break up the Arab states, create a little stateless, pretty much promote the very instability we're seeing today. And so the bigger picture, it's serving Israeli interests and certainly not American interests. The treasure and blood has been squandered. American credibility, that's America now is losing all its soft power, and apparently losing its hard power, given the advances of missile technology, the supersonic missiles that the Iranians have, the development of the BRICS, as that's sort of breaking out of the Western Jewish banking model. And this might explain the current instability and conflict. I think that this is the hidden grammar to what's going on in the Ukraine, is to prevent this condominium, if you will, between Europe and Eurasia and China, to maintain Anglo-American Jewish or Atlanticist dominance of the world, which is waning. And it's sort of, I think it's inevitable, the kind of opposition we're seeing now is inevitable. Something like sanctions, where I think two-thirds of the world is under U.S. sanctions at the Treasury Department, which is, of course, controlled by Jews, particularly the Sanctions Department. And every time they impose a sanction on Russia or Iran, it just gives Iran or Russia more incentive to break out of the Western economic mold. And that's and that just solidifies BRICS and alternative systems. And with the, we saw with this latest retaliatory strike, it was reported as aggression in the Jewish-controlled Western media as Iran was striking Israel. We forget that just 2 weeks prior, Israel had bombed a consulate in Syria, therefore violating the sovereignty of two nations of which it is not at war. She is not at war. Violating the, I think, the Vienna Agreement's international law in striking these countries. I think they also bombed Aleppo the week before, killing like 40 Syrians. And that's been going on since 2016 or 17. Israel just routinely bombed Syria. But this missile strike where they sent out the Iranians were able to strike directly from Iran, these missiles hit an Air Force base, I think, or a base in Israel. Their strategy was to send out these cheap drones that would exhaust the Iron Dome system while the missiles got through, which is a message, meaning that we have hard power now, so you better think twice before you strike at us.
In fact, I've got your email address.
Yeah.
I'll send you a short video. It's about 5 minutes long, and it's actually a documentary. It's about a 2003 exercise, American military exercise, involving the United States against a Middle Eastern country, which was obviously Iran. Mm-hmm. And the OPFOR, the Iranian forces, were commanded by a retired Marine Corps Lieutenant General, a former sergeant, for which I'm truly proud of him, who became a Lieutenant General. Really impressive record. And what he did was something very interesting. He knew that the United States, with the carrier battle group, would be attacking, would be taking out his air force, his air defenses, his communications, all of the cybernetic stuff. And so how he had a two-pronged strategy, and your comment on cheap drones overwhelming Iron Dome just prompted this memory. One of his strategies was that the way that he would communicate was the old-fashioned way, sort of the World War II way, landlines, motorcycle and bicycle runners carrying messages from command posts to different sites, different missile sites and different defense sites.
Carrier pigeons?
I don't think he used carrier pigeons. The carrier pigeons might have been eaten, so we'd have to watch out for that.
Messengers.
When he had the location of the American battle group,
yeah,
you can roughly estimate from an open source, James Fighting Ships. It's published annually. How many surface-to-air missiles they have? They've got phalanx and other close-range defense systems. But how many missiles they have? And he simply overwhelmed them. Started with the cheapest, oldest rockets and missiles he had, the unguided one. But the carrier battle group couldn't ignore them. They were coming in. And so when they finally ran out of missiles, then he was using his best missiles. He sank the entire carrier battle group except for the two submarines with it. Sank the battle group, the Marine division that was with it, the entire thing. And you know, the U.S. side screamed foul. You know, you can't do that. You can't win. He said, "I won." And so they said that they were going to, they being the probably someone in the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I don't know who it would be there, but whoever was overseeing the exercise said, "We're going to redo this and you can't do that." And so he walked out.
But the whole point of wargaming and having these exercises is to develop strategies and tactics that comport with the reality.
Yep, and this was even though the American side was using weapon systems that are, for the exercise that it wouldn't develop, actually have deployed for several years. So that made a great deal of difference to it. And but I was just thinking of that, that the advantages to these cheap things coming in, drone technology in particular, is that they're really cheap, but they can't be ignored. You don't know what it's carrying. You can't ignore them. And we have depended, we the United States, regardless of who pulls our strings, ever since Vietnam, have depended on minimizing casualties, our own casualties. And if it ever becomes apparent that we can't do that, I mean, the loss of a carrier battle would be catastrophic. It would make Pearl Harbor with 3,000 dead pale into insignificance. You'd probably have 20, 25,000 dead. That's not counting the Marine Division. So you'd probably have 50,000 dead if you lost a carrier battle group with an amphibious assault force. Something like that, or even the possibility of something like that. The good side is that it would probably make a conventional attack very unappealing. Bad side is that these chicken hawks in Washington, who do not know what war is like, would probably then decide, well, the only way to do this is with nuclear weapons, right off the stop.
Yeah, and that was back in October, right after the Hamas assault. You had people like Ben Shapiro and Mark Levin, I think, suggesting that Israel resort to nuclear weaponry, I guess using an arsenal that it allegedly doesn't have.
But they don't want to do that because they want the area of Gaza
Well,
for
yeah,
other
so.
purposes. So you can't, if you irradiate it with nuclear weapons, it's going to be a little tough to use.
Well, what's that? Are you suggesting that they bomb Europe? Sort of the this
I would think that the best thing that could happen, and I'm sorry for West Jerusalem, would be if the Israelis bombed Tel Aviv and Jerusalem.
Yeah.
That would be the best thing for world peace.
Well, it's again, it was
Oh, and Washington, D.C.
in Washington, D.C. Yeah, the source of all the pride. But the idea, this is, the what the what's that doctrine called? Samson option,
The Samson option. That
which is basically it's a threat to Europe.
I was not just to Europe. It's a threat to us.
Well, they have those submarines. Was it the Dolphin submarine class
Yeah,
that
the
Israel
Dolphin, they have six of them that the Germans built for them. They're extremely quiet. They've got cruise missiles, probably nuclear tip, almost certainly nuclear
Now,
tip.
did the Germans give it to him free as reparations for the Holocaust?
They gave them free. Yeah,
Yeah,
free. Angela Merkel. And the thing
ah,
that is, Angela Merkel
yeah.
grew to adulthood in communist East Germany. She was a communist. And she became the Chancellor of Germany, and you sort of think like she's carrying out the plan. There was one other thing that had occurred to me in the process of this, that when we were looking at what was happening in the Middle East, no one politically, except on programs like ours, but no one in the mainstream media ever mentioned that so many of the US government officials were and are dual Israeli citizens.
Yes, well, Anthony Blinken, when he went
Sure.
there right after, he says, "I first I come here as a Jew."
Yep.
Well, I thought you were U.S. Secretary of State, but then again, who am I?
Yeah.
I
Well,
come here as a Jew. So much for being an honest, broker or negotiator in this conflict. Conflict, of course, suggests two sides.
Well, I
Con
mean, it's,
conflict.
given the disparity of forces between what the Israelis have, and what Hamas has, you can't talk about that as a war. It's
No,
not even.
I that's one thing I'm tired of. We're referring to as a war, as if there's a organized resistance or armed or conflict.
I will share with you a tiny secret. And now that I've got your location on my GPS, the drone is already heading there. So. But the drone is going to carry Southern barbecue, and I think that will probably deflect you sufficiently. Back in the late 1970s, I was teaching at Catholic University in Washington, D.C. And I had a Jewish colleague who had formerly been at Camden College of Rutgers University. And Camden College was not a great place to be then. It's, I don't even know if it still exists right now. And, but he was really good on constitutional law. He was a very conservative con law guy. And there was a vacancy for that in the politics department at Catholic University. So I invited him to apply for the job. And he said, I can't make this. I think we've got enough conservatives down here. We can get you in. And we did get him in. And so the next year he came down there. He was so happy and so grateful to me. And shortly after that, Menachem Begin became Prime Minister of Israel. And I didn't say anything to him. I'm sure he knew what I thought of Begin. You know, going from the Haganah to the Irgun to the Stern Gang is not exactly a step forward. And one point, a few months after, later in the hall, he came over to me and he said, you know, I want to thank you for not saying anything about Begin. It is so embarrassing having him as Prime Minister of Israel. And he said, but, and we were talking about the USS Liberty, and I don't know how the USS Liberty got into it. It was one of Begin's officials had been chief of staff, I think it was Rabin at the time, in 1967 when the USS Liberty was attacked. And Steve, I'm using his first name, not his last. He died several years ago, so there would be no character assassination or insult. Although possibly the seventh generation would sue me for something. But we were talking about USS Liberty, and I said, well, you know, they attacked the USS Liberty, they being the Israelis, that it was a deliberate attack. He said, it was an act. I said, no. And I told him why it was deliberate. He said, well, they had a good reason to do it. And I said, why do you say that? He said, because I'm a Jew. I said, well, and I had, by the way, at the time, no idea that I had Jewish ancestry myself. My father and I had never talked about it, not because he didn't want to. It was unimportant to him, just like it was to me. In fact, any kind of ancestry would be unimportant. I'm an American, and that's the end of it. You know,
Yes.
the rest of the background, I even wrote an article of, you know, I identify my Jewish background in terms of cuisine, not foreign policy. And I always wondered why I like overstuffed dumplings. Well, now I know why. But I looked at him and I said, well, that depends on whether you think of yourself as an American who happens to be Jewish or as a Jew who happens to be living in America. And he stared at me and he said, I don't have to answer that question. This is verbatim. I've got a really good memory here. He said, I don't have to answer that question. I said to him, well, it wasn't a question, but had it been, you know, you provided an answer. Shortly thereafter, just this is before the 1980 election, he went to AIPAC and told them that I was a good guy and a smart guy and a patriot, but I should never be allowed in the US government because I was not a friend of Israel. And if I
Wow,
got
yep.
my foot on the first rung of the ladder, I was going to go up And so when the Reagan administration came in, my name was reportedly penciled in for two assistant secretaryships, one in state, one in defense. And AIPAC vetoed them. And that was the Jewish role. And I had no idea for 20 years. But I can't even tell you how many people have
But
had it
it
happen.
had no problem with Jonathan Pollock.
No. No. And I had no
Yes.
idea that even back then there was a selection process going on that wouldn't culminate for 20 to 30 years when the people who were the entry-level assistant and deputy assistant secretaries would then be full cabinet members. And that it took that long, but these people are patient. These people are patient.
That's something that most people, at least I think ethnic white Americans, because they just assumed it was their country and it was built by them and made for them, that's the sort of ethnic networking or ethnic politicking or organizing. That's something that we're not allowed to do, we're not supposed to do.
I mean, could you imagine if Americans of German, Italian, and Japanese and Irish ancestry had the same attitude as Jews have? The Germans would have won the First War, there wouldn't have been World War, there wouldn't have been a Second World War,
Yes.
and that was the end of
Well,
it.
there was some of that in the 30s, so the American Boone Party and German Americans, but they were shut down hard, and they even had the show trials. But and so to the extent that there were some German Americans or Irish Americans who didn't fancy going to war for the British Empire. And some of them even called out the Jew even then. But even then, as 1930s, the FBI was marshaled to shut them down. The American First Committee was shut down. It shut itself down, but it was effectively shut down by the government after Pearl Harbor.
There was one guy who had nothing to do with the ethnic part of it. Guy named Smedley Butler, who wrote a book called War as a Racket, published in the 1930s. And there was even a proposal, apparently, to J. Edgar to shut him down and arrest him. And wiser heads prevailed because Smedley Butler had retired as a major general in the United States Marine Corps. He was from a very wealthy Philadelphia mainline family, and in fact was the richest man in the Marine Corps when he was there. And he was one of five people to hold two medals of honor. And I guess suddenly someone prevailed on whoever wanted him thrown in jail and shut down, that if you arrested a retired Marine general with two medals of honor, something really bad was going to happen.
And that, I mean, back then there was something still of the WASP elite, which was an ethnic, basically they were the dominating ethnic group or that controlled the country. And it, I mean, obviously Jews had influences going as far back as before World War I. They were able to cancel like a trade treaty with Russia.
And I don't, not only the WASP group, but the Marine Corps would probably responded really badly to something like that.
Yeah, there's still some life to the system, some real diversity and competing interests, at that time. Before World War II, America wasn't quite as homogenized.
No, and it's or as not exclusively, but largely both emasculated and feminized.
Yes.
Both that. If any of the nonsense that Jewish groups are pushing internally, under this woke agenda, the drag queen shows and LGBTQ crap, if any of that crap had happened 60 years ago when I was a young man, I was just thinking back, looking at one of these shows, at the description of one of these shows, that I think almost every adult male and teenage boy would have picked up their rifles, their hammers from their workshops and their homes and nailed these bastards to the doors of something. I mean, literally nailed, not figuratively nailed,
Well, yeah,
literally.
there was an account I read. I think it was in Pat Buchanan's biography. Growing up in Washington, D.C. in the 1950s, there was some guy came in the neighborhood peddling pornography. Presumably, he was Jewish, and a bunch of Catholic fathers went and beat him up.
I'm surprised they only did that.
Yeah, and so this was this type of informal policing, local policing that was enabled. Of course, that's pathologized.
I
Technically, he
mean,
was lynched, right? But.
if you went and there was one show with everything, one video with everything properly, faded out of several nude men standing outside of a school in one of the blue states in the very woke cities. Tried that in the early 60s, you'd have a bunch of bodies up there.
Well, isn't that what they make flamethrowers for?
No, flamethrowers would be for disposing of what's left. I mean, these people wouldn't have been killed so quickly, they would have been killed slowly.
Yeah, it's
I mean,
this.
and people go, oh, you can't say that, but they should be.
Well,
You
they're
know?
grooming and molesting little children.
I know, I
I mean,
know. You know, it's, I mean,
what did Jesus say about this? Said, you know,
it's not Jesus, not only Jesus, the city fathers of Sodom and Gomorrah would be morally offended by what we're doing today. And that's pushing it.
Yeah. And as you said, you scratch the surface, it's Jewish organizations that are spearheading it. Obviously, they're not the only ones. I mean, not every organization, everyone in a organization advocating homosexuality, feminism, abortion, transgenderism, all, whatever manner of degeneracy, not everyone is Jewish.
No, but the leadership yes. is largely Jewish, and the financing is largely Jewish.
It's like Bolshevism. It was a Jewish movement. Not every Bolshevik was a Jew, but it was a Jewish movement. Yeah. And so when we're talking in political terms, we have to speak in these generalities and these categories, because that's the only way, you can organize a resistance and also identify an enemy. I mean, it's like,
Well, you know, I didn't realize this until a fairly few years ago, it wouldn't matter much, but when Lenin was in exile, mostly in Zurich, once he got out of old Russia, the Imperial Russia. And when Lenin left Switzerland to go to Finland Station, and, you know, the classic of him arriving and, you know, hands up on that, there were, 50 odd Bolsheviks who had been with him. And I don't know if they were all the Bolsheviks or just 50 or so of the premier ones who left Zurich with him for Finland Station. Every single one was Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
Every single one was Jewish. And even some of the post-Soviet literature will talk about, you know, 75 to 80% of the early Soviet government the first Soviet government was Jewish.
Yeah, that's why Stalin is accused of being anti-Semitic, because all his enemies were Jewish. Well, because all the early Bolsheviks were Jewish.
Yeah, no kidding.
The ones that he had to compete with, the ones that were independent of him. So he had to target all these, you know, original Bolsheviks, if you will, and they ended up, you know, Kamenev, Zinoviev, they're all Jewish.
Trotsky,
the biggest of all, right? Yeah.
Yep.
By the way, who the British and the Americans sent over, you know, from via New York to Canada, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and who gave him his gold? He wasn't a businessman. He wasn't an entrepreneur. He was a radical who paid his bills, right?
Yeah.
With Jacob Schiff and Company, right?
Yeah. Just sheer coincidence. Sheer coincidence all the way. That's one of the things that is an interesting precursor to I think what is now one of my current hobby horses is. Looking not so much at the uniparty in the United States, but almost as the Republicans and the Democrats being almost a two-circle Venn diagram, with the center, the overlap being Israel, complete loyalty to Israel. The neocons, and it's a true faction fight. And it was a faction fight just like, and I was talking about this yesterday afternoon, it's a faction fight like the faction fight between Stalin and Trotsky, or between the traditional Chinese leadership, communist leadership, and the Red Guards,
mm-hmm.
Cultural Revolution. But the Trotsky and Stalin, I think, is a really explicit one. That Stalin was convinced that what was important was what he called socialism, e.g. communism, in one country.
Yes.
Build up the Soviet Union, get it strong, then do something else. And to Trotsky, and he was like the neoliberals today who dominate the Democrat Party. They want to break the old system within the United States, well, within the West generally, but at least within the United States. And then on the ruins of the old system, build a new system. Stalin would agree with that. It's their, you know, the new, their it's their form of Jewish socialism, or whatever they're going to call it, their neoliberalism, their postmodernism, to grow it in one country first and do that and make sure you've got the U.S. online and as many European countries you can get as well, but the U.S. specifically. The neoconservatives in the Republican Party are like Trotsky, you know, world revolution, carry it off, go forward, go outside. Joe and I would be more like the neoliberals. Get it going in China. And the Red Guards were more push the revolution anywhere and everywhere you can, in addition to remaking the internal party. This isn't either or, there is an overlap. And what so many people fail to understand is that the common threads linking the two parties are not the simple difference between the ideology of the Democrat Party or the ideology of the Republican Party as they traditionally existed. You know, people like Kennedy and Truman would have, John Kennedy and Truman would have no place in the Democrat Party today. Traditional Republicans like Richard Nixon or Dwight Eisenhower would have no place in the Republican Party of today. Absolutely no place. None of them would. That the overlap is allegiance to Israel, and you saw that in the House of Representatives' little dancing show after the last aid package went through, is absolute allegiance to and loyalty to and subordination to Israel. Israel's not necessarily a government in Israel, and the governments are disposable and changeable, but to the country of Israel, to the concept of Israel. And beyond that, to Jewish financing and money and Jewish domination of the media as the ultimate determinant of who sits in the government, whether Democrat or Republican.
Yes, that's what's key, because this aid isn't formal, but it's there.
Yep.
It's a political reality.
And the last part is the only thing that I can see that would have taken people like Kristi Noem and Tulsi Gabbard and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. from the positions they had a year ago to the positions they have today.
That's right. Robert Kennedy chose as vice president Ken as the ex-wife of Sergey Brin at Google.
I saw that, I thought, oh God, you know.
He's tapping the Jewish money there, right?
By the way,
Google, that taps into Israel Unit 8200 and the whole, you know, integrated Western intelligence network, which is all either that's called integrated or infested with Jewish spies. And so there's simply the system is completely controlled at this point. Yeah.
You know. Yeah. But the one bit of good news. This is good news in the sense that the Titanic is shipping, but there's going to be enough wreckage from it that some of us might float.
Yeah.
it's that sort of good news.
It's got more lifeboats than the Titanic.
Yeah, the last type of people to succumb to this type of leverage, which is basically the threat of political extinction, not yet assassination, although I'm sure Robert F. Kennedy Jr. understands that's not an impossibility. Mm-hmm. It's just that these days, being so visible with so much on the internet, it's a little bit harder to knock off people at the top of the spectrum.
I think the deep state modified itself with Nixon.
Yeah.
You could get rid of a president without blowing his head off.
Yeah, you know that.
By the way, this doesn't. When a president is taken out, it's not an endorsement of that man or his presidency. It's just he's a stumbling block or an obstacle, like Trump.
Exactly. But that
someone's agenda.
That when you get people like that they're not capable of being bribed. They're not either true believers. I mean, there are a lot of evangelical Protestants, mostly in the Republican Party, exclusively the Republican Party, who are true believers. The Jewish members of the government and the Congress are true believers. Those you don't have to worry about. That's right.
Mike Johnson, the current speaker, said that he shepherded this aid package, this deal that he struck, largely because of his reading of the Old Testament, which means the Scofield Bible.
Yep, exactly. This came up yesterday afternoon. I said, but you know, I'm not a theologian. I'm not even a Christian. Sorry, guy, I'm not. I was, but not now. Vietnam had a certain interruption on that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see the Prince of Peace and the Lamb of God anywhere there on the field. That, by the way, is an iconoclastic position, and I understand that I'm, you know, maybe totally wrong, in which case my hope for Valhalla is probably my only possible out. You know, Valhalla and Valkyries, I can do it. But I do know something about the New Testament and a good deal about the Old, courses in comparative history. And to Peter, I mean, that's two, or Peter 2, if you wish, says explicitly that Christians are the new chosen people.
Yes, it's the new covenant.
That Jews as were the chosen people of the Old Testament, but what they did to Jesus and what happened afterwards, that Christians are the new chosen people.
Yeah, so, emphasis on were.
Yeah, so and with emphasis on were. So evangelical Protestants back Israel are effectively Jewish.
Yes, it's dual covenant. It's the dual covenant heresy that even the Catholic Church has acquiesced to, although they officially rejected it. It's in the minds of many Catholics. I hear it repeated to me all the time. Jews are the chosen people. No, they were the chosen people for a specific mission, reason.
And that term was never used by, I mean, most of my family was Catholic from Pontiac, Michigan. I probably went to more baptismal, confirmation, wedding, and funeral masses than most Catholics will in their lives, because I had about 70 cousins in Pontiac. Every time I turned around, one was either having a baby, going to confirmation, getting married, you know, getting buried. And that, you just keep, okay, on to Pontiac. Which week is it for Pontiac?
Yeah, which sacrament are we attending?
Yeah, you know, which are we in?
Yeah.
And I mean, no one talked about that, about the chosen people. Mm-hmm. No one did. Not in the 60s. In the 50s, early 60s. No one talked about that. But I mean, this combination was just so striking that I couldn't believe that these people, the true believers, even though that they are, if they're not Jewish, why the evangelical Protestants would go along with it, that none of them had the sense to get out of it. And of course, the Jewish groups in the 1960s began suborning a lot of what became the mega church pastors, the evangelical pastors. They did so with a clear understanding that where the pastors led, the flocks would follow, most of them did. So that group you can't worry about. That group, you know, Jews, evangelical Protestants, true believers who, for whatever reason, people like Mike Johnson who have accepted that. The second group are those who had to be bribed. Someone who's corrupt enough, okay, how much money can you give me? I'll do whatever you want. I mean, they're not hardcore, but you don't want them on your side as leaders. Mm-hmm. The third group is those who can be blackmailed. I mean, they've got enough skeletons in their closet. They look at it and say, now, we're not going to do anything to you. We'll just let everyone know that when you were 15 years old, you had sex with an 11-year-old girl, you know, or something equivalent to that. You know, now, these people aren't going to be happy, and they would be possible. They would be resentful, and resentful enough to kick the traces if they had an alternative. Now, not the people who can be bribed, not the true believers, the people who had to be blackmailed into it. If everyone else was willing to grit their teeth and close their eyes to whatever was nasty enough to permit them to be blackmailed. The hope for leadership is that last and smallest group, the ones who weren't true believers, who couldn't be bribed, wouldn't take a bribe, and who didn't have skeletons in their closet, sufficiently nasty enough. And I'm sure that everyone has a skeleton or two in their closet, unless they died at birth, that those people, and they couldn't be blackmailed. And those are the people who could be threatened with political extinction. I mean, if you assassinate them, they're gone, but you don't have them either. And people might be just slightly suspicious even these days. And these are the people like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Kristi Noem, Tulsi Gabbard, that the threat to them was political extinction when they had a potential for doing other things politically. And in the case of Kristi and Tulsi, who are young enough to have a lot of political options ahead of them, these are the people who would be the best opportunity, the best chance to flip as leaders. Those people would do it. And I think that what we need to do is talk about if we survive a post-postmodern America, where are the leaders going to come from? Virtually none of the elected national leaders are even potentially acceptable because they're compromised for one of the first three reasons. And we have to start looking for those few in the fourth. And I mentioned three, and I'm sure there's a few others out there. who had to be dragged kicking and screaming on the threat of political and perhaps personal extinction into being overtly supportive, not just quiet about, but overtly supportive of the Zionist agenda. That's the ones to look for, and that's the important ones.
In the early 19th century, there actually was an anti-Masonic party in the United States.
Yep, I know.
And it was acknowledging a real threat. Obviously, a lot of had occurred in the West, particularly not just the American Revolution itself, the founding of the country, which is largely a Masonic project. There's a lot of schizophrenic confusion on part of Americans about what it is and still is today, what it's becoming. Nevertheless, you did have an acknowledgement there was a conspiracy afoot. There were secret societies, there was scheming in these things. And this wasn't consistent with at least the advertised or claimed values or of America or how its political system operates with open elections, free press. But if you do have a secret society networks, they can suborn or undermine those systems, particularly a free press, if it's controlled by a particular ethnic group, no longer functions as a free press. And then if the government gets infested with agents of the secret society, then it will work with the controlled press to suppress information. And we see that today with the Twitter files, FBI, and the control of social media, and the imposition of hate speech by the... Today we have the ADL, not necessarily secret society, but it operates in the shadows. At least it can control public discourse to the point where there is no open discussion or debate about its role or the role of Jewish power in modern American society. And this is legitimate because this is the key issue. Probably most important issue confronting America today is how do we address, control, and deal with the reality of Jewish power in the United States, in the West? And if you can't address that issue, then you're just not, you're not showing up.
Well, because the only way you can do it, given the pervasiveness of it and the invasiveness of it, is to either exile or eradicate them.
Which has been done in the past, from what I understand.
It's been done. they say 109 countries. And, we're not talking about the Holocaust.
Whatever that was.
I'm pretty sure what it was. Yeah. First, is the international, the ICRC, the International Red Cross, looked at all of the camps, produced a three-volume study in 47, 48, which I have read, by the way, the entire three volumes. I got it on interlibrary loan, the first edition of it. The second edition of it has some of this removed. And it visited every single German camp, concentration camps, the labor camps, the work camps, the POW camps. And it had under 300,000 died from all causes. That includes POWs, Jews, homosexuals, everything, under 300,000 in all of the camps, most of them in 1944, 45, when the German transportation system had collapsed under Allied bombing. And there was a typhus epidemic in Central Europe. They died of disease aggravated by starvation, and typhoid fever is a wasting disease. Which is
What did Anne Frank die from?
Pardon me?
What killed Anne Frank?
She died of a disease.
Typhus.
I know.
Yeah. She wasn't gassed.
I know.
By the way, she was transferred out of Auschwitz.
And she used the ballpoint pen, which shows it Back to the Future. The thing is, not only did that at no time in my schooling, and I'm not going to talk about elementary school because I didn't talk about that, but in high school in the late 1950s or in the first 3 years of college in the early 1960s before I went off to Vietnam, was there word one in text or lecture about anything remotely approaching a Holocaust. World War II was simply World War I on a vaster and bloodier scale.
See, this is where you, Alan, are dangerous because you're an old man and you still have your memory. We have to we just have to wait you out.
What was your name again? what am I doing here? Who am I talking to?
Neither of us are young anymore, so we have a memory of a time before. You're a bit longer than me, a bit longer in the tooth, so you have a longer memory of me. But I too remember when World War II wasn't all about Jews or Nazis.
And I had three Jewish professors in college. Two were from Europe after World War II, were immigrants. One was from somewhere around the Rhineland. His name was Jacques Breitenbucher. He was probably Alsatian, Alsace or Lorraine or somewhere along the Rhineland. The other one was from somewhere in what was before World War II, northwestern Poland. Neither one gave any indication of suppressing horrible memories or said word one about anything like that. The one guy had come from about an area, he said it's about 40 miles from the town of Auschwitz, which was an industrial center. You may have heard of Auschwitz.
Yeah, I had something of it. Yeah, something.
Yeah, it's sort of passing reference to it. And he said it was a big industrial town. He said
I understand now it's a theme park. So
now he said there was sort of like he said there were a lot of German work camps.
Yeah.
And light industries around there.
Mm-hmm.
And I said yes, and that's all I said. There was no reason to react to anything else. The other one came from about 20 miles from a town called Dachau.
Yeah, I think the Western camps were the ones that were first kind of burnished in the consciousness of the West because of the efforts of the Allies with the propaganda with with Billy Wilder and the Eisenhower showing up who wanted to give he said we want to highlight these camps to show soldiers why they're fighting, and they brought in the Office of War Information and to come in and do the propaganda. This is where you get the human lampshades and these things, all this nonsense. Yeah,
in Crusade in Europe there is a reference, two paragraphs, one page, to a visit he made personally to the concentration camp at Oldenburg.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about how it looked like the Jews had suffered most and more than the others there. Now, word one about gas chamber, oven, crematoria, anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all in Crusade in Europe. That is all in Crusade.
Similar with Churchill, right, in his memoirs.
Yep, in his six-volume history of the Second World War, and in de Gaulle's two-volume memoir, which I read in French as well as in English to be sure that there wasn't an error in translation. Nothing there, not a word.
So what you have is an evolving narrative, which may or may not have anything to do with actual events.
And it had nothing to do with actual
events.
Yes,
so it's a propaganda.
I posted, again, on my BitChute channel, and I'm not pushing the BitChute channel, two videos called The First Liberation of Dachau by U.S. Troops, and then the other video is The Second Liberation of Dachau by U.S. Troops. They're both about 3 or 4 minutes long. The first liberation is on 27 April 1945. It starts with opening, it's a U.S. Army clip, U.S. Army film. It shows U.S. tanks, actually they're M24 light tanks, if you're interested in detail. M24 light tanks going into the town, to Stadt Dachau, and then U.S. troops going down on both sides of the road, German civilians there, one is cutting through the lines of U.S. troops, the one's cutting through the lines of U.S. troops for the shopping basket. No fighting, no violence. Then it goes down to the actual camp where the prisoners were being released. They're coming out and they're laughing and they're happy to be released from prison, not starving, no striped suits. And the Americans are there, they're clapping shoulders on them, and they're happy and they're eating and drinking, like really glad to get out the rations. The rations were pretty poor in the last several months of the war. Not anyone was eating well.
Mm-hmm.
Almost everybody was starving. But they're going through this and they were really happy to be out. There's no fighting. There's no fighting. And no starvation. None of the rest of that. The second film was 29 April, 2 days later, 1945. This is a Hollywood production.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something, it uses the same opening screen to give the impression of authenticity. It just didn't change the date because the date was 27 April 1945 or April 27th 1945, can't forget which. And that's what gives the impression of authenticity. And this starts off with fighting. troops, no tanks, infantry, most without their knapsacks. And the first film, the infantry has their knapsacks, heavy packs on. That's what troops did. They carry packs. They're fighting their way into the city. Somehow they got a camera overlooking over a machine gun that's firing. The only thing is the machine gun is a German MG-34. It's from a film clip.
Yeah.
And then you go into the horror show. These piles of bodies and these starved corpses in striped suits and all the rest of that. That's where that one goes. And if you look at the two of them, I suggest you go to that and just look at them yourself. You'll find some really interesting information there. Just looking at those two videos. The first video is Dachau the way I remembered it. The second, after the second, whatever happened afterwards, a couple of days after the first one, that's when whoever was there, I would guess mercenaries, possibly some U.S. troops, I don't really know, possibly both, killed over 600 Germans, camp guard, staff,
yeah,
the rest of it. What I did not realize until about 6 months ago is that included over 120 badly wounded soldiers who couldn't be evacuated. The Germans were still retreating, couldn't be evacuated from the general hospital. There were about 120 wounded soldiers from the 12th Waffen-SS Division, Hitlerjugend, who had been brought there and couldn't be moved. They were killed in their beds.
There would be Hitler Youth?
Yeah, no, there was a Hitler Youth Division. That's what they called it. They were volunteers from the Hitler Youth. They had a cadre, mostly from the 1st Waffen-SS Leibstandarte Division and some others. Average age was 15.
Wow. Minors, children.
They fought. They stopped the Canadian division dead in its tracks, literally and figuratively. They stopped a British and an American division. They took heavy losses, huge losses, because they had no experience. They had been trained with weapons as in the Hitler Youth. They had a cadre of NCOs and officers from other SS divisions, mostly the 1st SS, I understand, but I'm not positive of that. And they fought. They fought. Not Boy Scouts, they fought as troops, you know, anti-tank weapons, tanks, tank crews, infantry, the rest of it. And they were about 20% of the ones murdered by whoever went through on the 29th of April.
Yeah. Well, Elie Wiesel, in his book Night, which he didn't write, it was written by a Frenchman, doesn't mention gas chambers at Auschwitz.
Nope. And not only that, he mentions how poor the medicine available to his friend was when he visited him in a hospital.
Yes.
Why
hospital,
would the Germans,
yes.
Yeah, why would the Germans running death camps, you know, in addition to wasting time, money, and resources for years on imprisoning them, if they wanted to kill them, they could kill them the way the Soviets killed Ukrainians, exposure in the winter. But, I mean, why would they be in a hospital?
And then he and his relative, didn't they escape with the Germans?
Twice.
So why would they escape with their tormentors? Yeah.
In one, he gave a Newsweek interview and his book. And I think in one of them, I don't know which one, I think in the Newsweek interview, he talked about waiting to be liberated by the Red Army and retreating with the Germans. And the other one, he talked about waiting in the West to be liberated by the Americans. So I guess he had the joy of crossing Poland and Germany in order to be liberated both by the Russians and the Americans.
Mm-hmm. You have Anthony Blinken's stepfather, who apparently was liberated by a black battalion, tank battalion, right?
Yeah.
Made up story, of course.
Oh, of course.
It's like,
but hey, when all the entertainment media and all of the news media are owned by people who are part of the story, who will question him?
Well, he can't be questioned because he has relatives who died or almost died in the Holocaust. Same with our Attorney General, and same with
Mayorkas said the same thing.
Yeah,
you can't question him.
Merrick Garland can't be guilty of anti-Catholic bigotry because he's Jewish.
Yeah.
Really?
Really?
It's like,
I mean, where is the Holy Office when we need it?
there's a long history of anti-Catholic bias on the part of Jews, not just persecution, political
Yeah.
persecution,
And you know,
cultural warfare, and all that,
the thing that I find so fascinating, the thing that I find so fascinating, having actually read a fair amount of the Torah in English with commentary and a third of the Talmud and the Quran, is that in the Quran, Jesus, Abraham, and Moses are considered holy prophets, predecessors to Muhammad. And Mary, the mother of Jesus, is easily the most revered woman mentioned in the Quran, and I've read it three times. If you look in the Talmud, Jesus is described as a heretic and a blasphemer who is spending eternity in boiling excrement. And his mother Mary is described, and that's explicitly described. And his mother Mary is explicitly described as an adulteress and a whore. And Christians back the Jews. Isn't
Well,
that
as
interesting?
John Paul II said, he said, Jews are our elder brothers.
Yeah, can you imagine?
Well, that doesn't appear in the Bible anyway. Someone commented that, well, in the Bible, elder brothers don't come across looking so good. So some people suggest John Paul
Perhaps,
II was being clever there.
the Pope hasn't read the Bible.
Well, he's Catholic. He was
Right, yeah, you know,
Catholic.
or he hasn't read the Quran or the Talmud. Anyway,
But the words, I mean,
I have to run in about 1 minute. So
yeah, but I mean, while we're talking, getting to the Holocaust, obviously we've seen this sort of push for Holocaust education, anti-Semitism, a lot of the hysteria we see because of fear of a second Holocaust. Is the Holocaust, I think, hangs over all of this because
hey, there
that narrative prevents us from criticizing Jews. That's
it
the
does it does, and I and there is actually a lawsuit. This is a joke, by the way. There is a lawsuit by the Chinese against the Jews because there's soon going to be more Holocaust memorials than Chinese restaurants scattered around the United States.
By the way, I'm all for Holocaust education and debate. Oh, wait a
Debate is
second. You
one
can't
thing.
have that.
What can't be debated isn't true.
That's right.
That's simply, I mean, the fact that something can be debated doesn't mean that it is untrue, but anything that can't be debated, anything that is it is illegal to debate, is an obvious lie.
Yes. What are you afraid of?
Yep.
Why don't you employ that high verbal IQ and win the
Sure.
debate?
Judaism, Christianity, Islam, any one of these may be true. Any one of them may be true. All of them may be true for that matter. But I mean, regardless of one's faith, it is possible to sit down and have a discussion about any one of them as on a religious basis. I have sat down and had some interesting discussions with Augustinian priests and Jesuit priests about aspects of the faith and other faiths. And there has been no question at all, no problem at all with that. They're perfectly willing to discuss, debate, argue. You can do all of it.
But as you found out, if you do question a Jew or call him out on a particular matter, whether it's U.S. liberty or some other matter, very likely they'll work behind the scenes or work within their network to prevent you from getting job promotions or certain
No
job
kidding.
positions.
No kidding. Yeah,
Right? And that's that informal network. They used to call it dynamic silence, and it's no longer silent anymore. It's obvious. It's cancel culture. It's Jewish lawfare. Alan Dershowitz has advocated bankrupting critics of Jews, abusing the civil court system. He should be disbarred and fired from Harvard for this. He won't, of course, but he's advocating the weaponization of law to shut down critics, Jewish lawfare, and that's another problem that we can have the First Amendment, but if you have Jewish lawfare, then it's meaningless.
yep,
So,
exactly.
well, Dr. Sobroski, I want to thank you for coming back on the show.
I have enjoyed it tremendously. I always do. This is very, very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Enjoy your spring. Enjoy the birds.
I will, and also the groundhogs.
Oh,
They're
okay, that
out,
too.
and I've seen bear tracks.
Oh, okay. Black bear, right?
And in fact, people on a neighboring farm have seen a black bear, fortunately, I don't know if there are grizzly outs in western Pennsylvania. I hope I
Shouldn't be,
run into
shouldn't
one.
be.
But a black bear with a cub, and you don't want to get between
No,
them.
no, 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 no.
But
Unlike,
I enjoyed this tremendously. Thank
unlike
you
human
very much.
beings, mama bears protect their children, right?
Yeah. Unlike others.
Unlike
Unlike
others.
others. But that's a subject for another talk.
Yes, so much. Thank you so much. I'll let you go.
You take care of yourself. Best of luck. And thank you very much for having
You're
me.
welcome. Take care. Bye-bye.